Welcome to the Podium and Panel Podcast.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
Is that the end of this case?
How did this come about? Are you in the pay of the Microsoft Corporation?
Start with the text of the Second Amendment.
Your Honor, I think that could be viewed as political, that would be...
How about the First Amendment?
No, Your Honor, I don't think the First Amendment...
You're out again. Still out.
I think we're all next.
Welcome to episode 144 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. Three cases today, all from the Seventh Circuit. A theme of triple sevens, blackjack, or triple sevens. That happened to be the only court that was really hearing cases in this shortened holiday week. The first case today is Arrow Technologies LLC versus those parties listed on Appendix A. Yes, that's the actual caption.
That's got to be one of the better titles as opposed to, you know, the other one right. We had from the Seventh Circuit a couple of years ago was Appellee versus Appellant.
Right.
That was fun.
Right.
I always do love a good people versus some sum of cash. That's right. Always good in a forfeiture case. But this is good. The people,
it is.
Those parties listed on Appendix A. Okay.
Right. A part of it is anybody who's been involved in one of these bankruptcy cases, as we'll get into a little bit. There's a lot of creditors, a lot of debtors, a lot of third parties, a lot of interested parties. So yes. It gets kind of crazy. The second case today is Crothersville Lighthouse Tabernacle versus Church Mutual Insurance Company. And the third case today is 13 Investment Company, Inc. versus Foremost Insurance Company. Let's turn to our first case. On the same day that Johnson & Johnson filed a new bankruptcy plan following the rejection of their first plan by the Third Circuit for claims arising out of TELC claims, the Seventh Circuit heard an appeal from the bankruptcy of Arrow Technologies related to the earplug MDL litigation, which is the largest MDL in history. And if you've been around Chicago or almost anywhere, even when I travel, I sometimes see ads for earplug litigation. The questions presented to the Seventh Circuit are, number one, whether the bankruptcy court erred in concluding that the automatic stay of 11 U.S.C. 362A1 categorically cannot apply to actions against a non-debtor, even when there is such an identity between a non-debtor and the debtor that a judgment against the non-debtor would effectively be a judgment against the debtor, or litigation against the non-debtor would cause the debtor irreparable harm. Number two is whether the bankruptcy court erred in concluding that the automatic stay of 11 U.S.C. 362A3 does not apply to actions against a non-debtor, resulting in a diminishment of estate property, provided the debtor can purportedly replenish those assets with other assets. Number three was whether the bankruptcy court erred in concluding that courts lack related to bankruptcy jurisdiction to preliminarily enjoin a pending action under 11 U.S.C. 105A, unless the debtor shows that continuation of the action will have an actual economic effect on this estate rather than a potential effect. Pat, tell us about oral argument in this bankruptcy matter, which is in neither of our true fairways.
Indeed not. So if you came here to learn about bankruptcy law, you came to the wrong place.
Right.
This is going to be high level and maybe not even good. We're going to do what we can, though, because it's interesting and important. As Dan said, this MDL, and for those that aren't familiar, MDL means multi-district litigation. And cases involved with plaintiffs as multi-district litigants make up over half of the federal docket together. In this MDL alone, there are 290,000 claims that have been scooped up within this MDL. This involves a earplug or product that didn't plug ears, as it turns out. And Arrow is a wholly owned subsidiary of 3M. Yes, that 3M, who has, you know, plenty of money. No problem with being able to pay this debt. Just like Johnson & Johnson doesn't really have a problem paying the debt and the talc claims. All of these claims are for earplugs that were sold to members of the United States military.
Yes.
And that they took not only at the range, but also in the combat, that have left allegedly, you know, many of these folks, if not all of them, with hearing loss. So this is a huge piece of litigation, and what in order to insulate 3M, what they did is they had Arrow declare bankruptcy, and then there's a funding agreement whereby 3M will fund Arrow Technologies to pay the various debts. And so then they sought a stay of the underlying proceedings because of the bankruptcy, and they sought it also for actions against 3M. There's an automatic stay with respect to the actual debtor. The issue here is whether you also stay the actions with regards to 3M. Now, as it turns out, there is a stay in place, but for different reasons in the MDL. But 3M is trying to use this to stay the actions against it. And we'll see if that works. I will say it didn't go well, and it didn't go well despite the fact that the lawyer for Arrow is Paul Clement. They brought out the big guns for in this particular case. And actually we talk about Clement periodically on the show, as he's a frequent flyer, or the most frequent of flyers, I should say.
Yes.
At the Supreme Court. In a couple next week on Tuesday, Lisa Blatt is going to argue in the Third Circuit on the 8.4G case from Pennsylvania. So we'll talk about that case next week in another very frequent flyer before the Supreme Court in that particular case. But the issue in this case, and correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, it was Judge Easterbrook who brought up, you know, the United States Supreme Court has really said and told us in the last 10 years that the stay only applies to certain parties. It doesn't apply to other parties. All the cases you've cited are before this recent move by the Supreme Court. And don't we really have to take our cues from the high court? And I'm not sure he got an answer that was very satisfactory in any way.
I don't think
so. The other issue is the scope under Section 105 of the Bankruptcy Code that allows judges to do, at least under Clement's theory, anything they want. And I'm not sure the judges on the Seventh Circuit were buying that either, because I don't think that they thought you can do anything you want. It seems that only certain things are within the purview, and in 105 doesn't trump what's in 362. 362 is the provision of the Bankruptcy Code that stays things once someone declares bankruptcy, and woe betide the party that violates that thing. As we saw a couple weeks ago, there was an affirmance of a $10 million or $11 million judgment in the Seventh Circuit. This was a case that was handled by my former firm on behalf of the debtor, who got $10 or $11 million sanction for violations of the bankruptcy stay. The underlying plaintiff tried to be creative and got creative to the tune of $11 million. So the stay really means things, and you can't really mess with that.
No.
It's the reason why this is important, and the Johnson & Johnson case is important, because they deal with so many cases. And the use, these are two different uses. The Johnson & Johnson case was this Texas two-step theory, where you create this separate entity, you fund it, you create it in Texas, and then you fund it, and then what happened in this case, everyone objected. And now, so that was like they funded it to like 2 point some billion. And now their new plan is they funded it to just short of 9 billion, 8.9 billion. And I think some of the plaintiff's attorneys have said, sure, great, this is wonderful. And others have said, screw you, not enough. You just need to pay the claims as they come. And obviously, you know, for obvious reasons, Johnson & Johnson is not excited about that prospect.
Not at all.
This is a bit different. The Johnson & Johnson situation is a bit different than the Arrow situation, because Johnson & Johnson actually manufactured the talc was theirs. Whereas in Arrow, this was a company that pre-existed, you know, was making these things, was then bought by 3M and is a wholly owned subsidiary. So it's a little bit different in those ways, which may be the reason why the bankruptcy was a bit different. Another thing, I think it was Judge Hamilton that brought up. So because Arrow is a wholly owned subsidiary of 3M, you have this funding agreement. Couldn't you just cut them off and declare them in breach and void the whole thing? Well, that, you know, what's to stop you guys from just doing that? Does it sound, it seems that it might be allowed under the agreement, which kind of defeats the whole point. These are really big, important cases, because how you deal with these mass tort situations, because of the amount of litigation that they represent within the federal system, and these scoop up cases from the state system too, is really, apparently there's like 2,000 state court cases brought against 3M in Minnesota. So there's all these cases. This is a lot of litigation. There's a lot of money at stake. And how this gets dealt with is really critical to the civil justice system generally. You can't discount the role that litigation funding plays in this. Advertising, all of the issues related to civil justice are wrapped up in these kinds of cases. And bankruptcy is one of the tools that the large defendants are using to try to mitigate these risks. So far, not so good. We'll see if that continues. Dan, what are your thoughts?
I agree with you, Pat. And, you know, one of my colleagues works with me sometimes on opinions for investments and things, and the, you know, elimination or stays from bankruptcy and safe harbors and stuff. As you mentioned, I took bankruptcy in law school, and it was one of the best books I ever had. I can't, I may still have it around somewhere, but I may have gotten rid of it because it's so old. But the nice thing about it was on the left side of the paper, it had the actual law. And then on the right side, it had like layman's terms and kind of some examples and kind of guided you. It was a very cool book. And
it's kind of like when I was studying classics, and you would get the, on one page would be the Greek or Latin, and on the right-hand side of the page would be the English.
Yep.
It was there are these lobe editions of, and so you'd have, it's like you have them on both, they'd face each other. Greek,
right?
Or Latin on one side, English on the other.
Which was good. And so it's a very complex area of law. Like you said, the violating a stay, knowingly violating a stay, is serious business. You know, there's good reasons for that. You know, it's interesting you talk about these earplugs and stuff. And I, several months ago, I haven't used them yet. I keep forgetting when I go to concerts. But as you know, I go to concerts and some are loud. And these are called eargasm earplugs. And they're supposed to be used by rock stars and stuff, and really, you can still hear the music, but it filters it so that it's like your Apple Watch that warns you that you're in loud spaces. So next time I go to a concert, I'll have to use them. But it is an interesting case and important. Yeah,
I've often thought about, you know, with all of the advent or the almost ubiquitous use of earphones, that I should really get into audiology, because there is going to be an entire generation of people that can't hear anything. Because,
right.
I mean, when you're standing, you're on the street, you can hear someone 10 feet away. You can hear it, like, not just that there's sound, but like detect what it is.
Right.
Or, you know, it's like, boy, he's not going to be able to hear anything soon.
Right.
I think that's my version of plastics from Mrs. Robinson is audiology. That's what you should get into. So
there you go.
With that, we'll take our first break and come back with the intersection of legal malpractice and insurance coverage. Always a good time. We're back for segment two of episode 144 of the Podium and Panel podcast, and quote, "The larger question here is certainly about when courts can and should rescue a client from its own lawyer's mistakes. What limits do you see to your theory here? Because frankly, what concerns me is that it looks as if everybody can get a mulligan, at least if they are willing to blame their lawyer. Or if they don't get a mulligan, they at least get a chance to argue for one and put the other side to another round of litigation." End quote. That was the question from Judge Hamilton, followed shortly thereafter by the following from Chief Judge Sykes. "The exceptional circumstances requirement for plain error review in civil cases, which is extraordinarily rare, very, very rarely granted, that requirement, it focuses on the nature of the error below. And the error below is a garden variety mistake by a lawyer not to advance the best argument and back it up with law and facts. He instead advanced other arguments that were no good. There is nothing exceptional about that. That happens every day." End quote. Well, that's nice to hear that Chief Judge Sykes thinks a lot of the lawyers that are in front of her.
Are crap.
Yeah, we have to read your drivel.
Slinging chip beef is their arguments.
Exactly. So those were among the questions asked by a panel of the Seventh Circuit last week in Crothersville Lighthouse Tabernacle. Say that three times fast. Versus Church Mutual Insurance Company. A coverage dispute arose between the insured and the insurer following a fire that destroyed the church. Delays in processing the claim ensued and rebuilding the church did not commence, so the insured filed suit. Summary judgment was entered by the district court in favor of the insurer, and while the matter was on appeal, and after the opening brief had been filed, the insured's lawyer was removed from the Seventh Circuit's bar, and new counsel came in for the insured, setting forth the following question. Quote, whether this court should excuse Lighthouse Tabernacle's limited forfeiture and reverse in part when A, plain error resulted from an incompetent lawyer's failure to make a dispositive argument, and B, affirming would create bad incentives for insurers and lawyers. Dan, tell us about the oral argument.
Thank you, Pat. And as you mentioned, you know, Chief Judge Sykes was not necessarily buying into this plain exception argument. And so
neither was Judge Hamilton. They just had different ways of framing it. Judge Hamilton's was more focused on the practical.
Right.
And Chief Judge Sykes was very focused on the policy and on the doctrine.
Right.
Not surprising considering their approaches, but they were at the same place.
Who was the third judge? I couldn't make out the voice.
He may have been sitting by designation.
He asked one question or something. I don't recognize that voice at all.
I listened to a good bit of the sitting and or that morning where he was sitting. I did not recognize the voice. I did not hear him identified by one of the advocates or one of his colleagues. And so I didn't know who it was. It seemed to be an older, just by the voice, seemed to be an older judge, which, as I said, could be that he was sitting by designation. But I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
I didn't recognize him as one of the regulars, let's say that.
Yeah. And for those...
It didn't sound like one of the judges who was just not feeling well that day. It didn't sound like that either.
Yeah, no. And before I forget, we talked about MDL and we talked about Easterbrook repeatedly with his acronyms. I judged the UIC Law School oral arguments Thursday night, Pat, and one of the advocates used four or five acronyms. It was just USPS for United States Postal Service, RBCs for the type of worker, and I told him at the end, I said, I didn't use the line of Easterbrook, but you don't use those acronyms. You're using like, you know, you're going to get blasted in front of certain courts, but in any event.
One court in particular. Did I tell you I went to they had a panel of the new judges on the Second Circuit, and one of the things that Judge Kirsch brought up is about acronyms. Don't do that. And he quoted Judge Easterbrook's way of framing the question: use English words. And so we are specialists. We're generalists, not specialists. This whole bit. And so the message has gotten to his colleagues.
So as you mentioned here, we have a situation had to do with a church that there was a fire at the church, pretty much a complete destruction. And then there was this whole process. When the appellee stood up, she talked about what the appellant was saying was that this delays and the issues, notwithstanding the work of the counsel for the insured, who, as you mentioned, had been removed from the bar. And, you know, I think everybody said, you know, thankful that the appellant's current attorney said, you know, we're thankful, you know, that he's not part of this anymore. But in any event, the argument of the appellant in this case was that in the briefs and other things, he approached certain things in terms of delays and certain in terms of the approach, and the appellant was trying to hear, you know, this new lawyer was valiantly trying to say, you know, there was that, so the lawyer did some bad things, and as you mentioned, you know, Sykes said, you know, the lawyers make choices every day, and sometimes they pick the wrong arguments or weaker arguments, but that's not plain error. It doesn't happen, as you mentioned, Pat, very often, as the quote suggested from Chief Judge Sykes. In the civil context, they were trying to get some context, because in the criminal arena, it happens much more. What's the plain error in the case of at the criminal level? Sentencing guidelines are not used right, or there's some exculpatory evidence or something. And again, there's the consequences are different, right? It's someone's going to jail.
Consequences are someone's freedom as opposed right. to someone's money.
Right, right. Even death, depending on the situation.
Or death. Yeah.
But when the appellee stood up, she said, look, this is, you know, this whole timeline and things is not really as presented by the appellants. What really took place here was that Church never in this case, according to her and according to the record, I guess, never denied coverage. You know, you and I both do a lot of insurance coverage. We've talked about a lot of cases here. There was never a denial letter. There was never a, hey, we're not paying for the church. What had happened here, according to the appellee's lawyer, when she stood up and argued, was that the insured, through his counsel, sent a letter. There was this appraisal process that is in the insurance policy. Some of these, and there was discussion about replacement value and actual cash value, as we've talked about on this show before. But the policy apparently has an appraisal process. It's pretty common in some of these property disputes. Also an operating agreement sometimes when there's 50-50 ownership. Is each party appoints an appraiser. Those two appraisers get together. Sometimes in these situations, the appraisers are close because it's a church, you know, the special work or whatever, to rebuild the tabernacle that burnt. Sometimes the two appraisers come together and they're within a range. Other times, they're way off. One says it's worth $500,000, the other says it's $2.5 million. And then what this policy provided for and the claims process provided for was the appointment of an appraiser, an umpire. According to Church's counsel, Church Mutual's counsel, they had sent a letter saying, you know, here's our appraiser. We're waiting for your appraiser. Then we needed this umpire.
And instead, the insurer just filed suit and claimed a delay
right,
in bad faith.
Right, right. And okay. And that's, yeah, yeah. And there was talk about a 180-day period that was in the thing about, taking action and starting to build and things. There was talk about that there had been payments made in this case. It was unclear to me exactly how much was paid. There was a proof of loss that was submitted. That was paid. Then there was a second round, and some more money was paid. The
proof of loss wasn't as good as the first one, it sounded like.
Right, right. And it sounds like at some point soon, that Church Mutual is going to hit policy limits on this policy again. The real issue here is, you know, again, I think it's an interesting case because, again, the appellant's trying to argue, look, this was plain error of the underlying counsel. As the quotes that you read, Pat, weren't the only quotes. The appellant lawyer really was having a tough time between Sykes and Hamilton. They were repeatedly bouncing off each other and really asking tough questions about, wait a second, like, again, how is this plain error? Right, that the standard for plain error is pretty darn high, that you can't just, like you said, I think the Mulligan quote is perfect, because if it happens again in the criminal context, what you see almost every time, and almost not every time, but often, is you see ineffective assistance of counsel, right? And over the years, the courts have become skeptical of it, because it can't be that every lawyer that defends somebody, every plaintiff's lawyer, If you got it wrong in the first go around, and then you get new counsel and they come in and say, you know what, that Dan Cotter used a terrible argument in the underlying case, and now I'm going to correct it, and it's plain error for the court to have made determinations based on that on the record. So I think it's an interesting case. I think the appellant here has an uphill battle given the arguments.
Yeah, what both Judge Hamilton and Chief Judge Sykes were trying to get out of appellant's counsel, in which they weren't able to get, I don't think, was a line.
Right.
Where's the line?
Right.
How do we know? I mean, at one point, I think one of them said, is it like pornography? Do I know it when I see it?
Right.
I mean,
right.
Because
that was Sykes.
Because is this, I mean, there's got to be a line because then they almost got into, arguments about the malpractice. Because one of the defenses to professional legal malpractice is it's attorney judgment. They said, well, this was just a judgment he made. Okay, he judged wrong. Does that make it malpractice? I don't know. The fact that this lawyer has been removed from the Seventh Circuit bar. He apparently, I think he also suffered at least a suspension, if not more consequences from the state of Indiana bar.
Okay.
So I when I looked up his name just to try to figure out what had happened, after I figured out who had filed the briefs initially, when I looked on Westlaw docket, I got his name and then I was able to, I Googled him and I saw that he suffered at least a suspension, I believe, from from Indiana. I'm not sure what it was related to. It's not relevant because what's here. So what happened here initially was he filed a brief that wasn't substantively deficient, but was procedurally so deficient they gave him 7 days to file a procedurally compliant brief. And that's when the new lawyers came in. Now let's say for the new lawyers that came in, the new lawyers are from the Plews firm. We've talked nearly every Indiana coverage case we've talked about involves right. the Plews firm from the policyholder side. The G&G case we talked about the cyber attack and the ransom situation, Plews. The IRT cases, both of them, the Plews firm. So, you know, a lot of these cases involve the Plews firm from in Indiana. Very, very, very good policyholder lawyers over there in Indiana.
There.
And they took this case on. I don't know under what terms they took it, but they're giving it the old college try, trying to get this church something. Another, I was mentioned at the beginning that Judge Hamilton, very practical. He asked, "Well, is there malpractice insurance?"
He did.
What is the status of the reconstruction of the church? And as a good lawyer, the appellant's counsel is like, "Well, that's not on the record, but I can answer your question."
Right.
The answer to the first question was yes, but there's not enough. And the answer to the second question is that's not the record, but it's the church has had to take loans and is having to so. You know, he was prepared for, you know, the practical realities of the situation, which are, this is not good for the church. I mean, it's a
right.
church.
Right.
And it sounds like the insurance company, for whom I will say in the past at my old firm, we did do some work for both liability and our both third party work and coverage work. They specialize in writing policies of insurance for churches. That's what they do. So,
And they're not hardline.
They're pretty sympathetic insurers,
right.
churches, for goodness sake.
Right.
Not well-moneyed, usually.
No. They're in some ways like USAA, where their claims practices and stuff, they're very reasonable generally, because, again, the types of clients, it's like Alps with lawyers or whatever the Alas or whatever it is that has like the philosophy, right, because it's, you know, you're treating your insureds with respect and, you know, all that stuff. But in
right.
any event,
I mean, you take, any of these mutuals where it's specialized in the particular kind. So with USAA, it's veterans, Church Mutual, it's churches, or ISBA, it's ISBA Mutual, it's the members of the
bar.
State bar. So that's who their members are. Their board are members of the bar. So they act accordingly usually. So with that, we'll take our next break and come back with segment 3 of episode 144 of the Podium and Panel Podcast.
Hey, Podium and Podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiumandpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podium and Panel Podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
So segment 3 of episode 144 of the Podium and Panel podcast. What obligation, if any, does an insurer have to an insured when the insurer issues a check with the insured, the public adjuster, and the mortgagee listed as payees on the check? The insurer delivers the check to the public adjuster as called for by the contract between the insured and the PA, and then the PA forges the other payee signatures and absconds with the money. That is the question to be answered when the Seventh Circuit decides 13 Investment Company versus Foremost Insurance Company. The decision of the district court is, don't need that. There being no dispute as to coverage, the insurer issued a check of the amount of the fire damage to a property owned by the insured. The insured engaged the PA, who was appointed as the agent of the insured. A settlement was negotiated, and the insurer issued a check for the full amount of the damage, but the PA forged the signatures and took the money. Both sides argued the import of 810 LCS 5/3-414C. An additional issue raised by the insured is that a representative of the insurer allegedly told the insured that the proceeds would be paid in installments following inspections, despite the provisions of the policy that hold otherwise. Pat, tell us about the oral argument in this case.
So you may think that this is a rather unique circumstance. I'm here to tell you that it's not.
It's not.
I had a case. I've had cases where we had PAs and try to figure out how to get them paid. And I've actually had a case where we had this dispute and I filed an interpleader because they couldn't agree on how to split up the money. And I was like, all right, I'm going to write. And so we ended up filing an interpleader. Had that case before. And it was funny because the lawyer that came in for the PA was a policyholder lawyer. And what he couldn't get over for the lawyer for the insured was, he wants to pay you the money. You take the money. You take the money that the insurance company is paying. We want to pay you. Just tell us how. But I did have another case where a lawyer, he's not a lawyer anymore, but he was then, forged the check. So it was a liability case. We agreed to an amount, and we needed to protect the interest of the workers' compensation carrier. So we put the carrier on the check. And check gets negotiated, case gets dismissed, everything is good. 6-7 months later, I get an email from the carrier. Hey, did you guys pay us? I'm like, yep, here's the check. We didn't get the money. Here's the back of the check. Send them the back of the check. Several months go by, and I get a motion. A motion under 1401 with a petition to intervene. To reinstate the case, and then for the carrier to intervene into the case. You can actually do this. There's a case that says you can do this. It was bizarre that we had a petition to intervene on a case that was dead. So we show up, and they didn't cite any case law. We get there, and they get to the bench, and they cite two cases. Said, Judge, I haven't seen these cases, but I would like to deal with this today. I don't think they can do this because they can go sue the banks. The check, what had happened was this lawyer, who is no longer a lawyer, had signed his name, his client's name, and the adjuster from the carrier's name. And the check for over $200,000 was negotiated. So they cite the cases. I call back to the office. I call my colleagues, hey, print these or PDF these, or get find these cases, get them to me. I got to read them. I read them. I step back up and said, Judge, these cases deal with situations where they didn't have recourse against the banks. They have recourse against the banks here. The banks screwed up. They shouldn't negotiate the checks. We delivered the check we were supposed to. We put them on the check. We did exactly what we agreed to do and what we're required to do to protect their interest. And the court said, yeah, you can't do this. Last I heard of the case, thank God. But this is not, this is a thing that happens. And the idea of putting multiple payees on a check is to make sure they're protected. People will remember when the Medicare first began a big issue in settling bodily injury claims. One of the solutions that people came up with is, well, we'll just put Medicare on the check. And then the plaintiffs' lawyers realized very quickly they couldn't get the checks negotiated because right. Medicare wouldn't sign the checks. So they're like, no, you can't do that to me. So what we had to do was start issuing separate checks. Or, you know, Illinois has devised a procedure where the plaintiff's lawyer holds the money in trust until they get the final demand letter from Medicare. But in this situation, the insurer paid the money, the entire, again, this is just like the last case we talked about. There's no dispute as to coverage. There's not even a dispute in this case as to how much coverage there is. Everyone agrees. They paid the agreed to amount, and the PA just left. Like the other case where you had Judge Hamilton very, very worried, or very concerned, not worried, but concerned about the practicality of the situation, he asked, is the public adjuster judgment proof? Have you gone after the banks? You know, in this case, they in fact deposed, I can't believe this, they deposed the public adjuster who agreed that he had forged the checks. It's like, why didn't you have him arrested while you were at it? He stole, you know, I don't know what his portion, typically a PA's in is $15,000, or sorry, 10%, which in this case would be $15,000 plus whatever work he was, because he was also hired to do some of the construction work. So whatever in addition he was owed on that. So he was owed a fraction of what was paid, and then the mortgagee need to get paid. I mean, this poor insured is getting it from both ends, because not only doesn't he have his building rebuilt, but he also has to still pay this mortgagee. Well, who's going to foreclose on a burnt building? But it's happened. It certainly was going to happen in one of the cases I was talking about. So I think it's very clear the insurer did what they were supposed to do.
Yep.
This gets into agency law, and that plainly the PA was the agent appointed by the insured. And be more careful who you hire as your PA. The other thing was the argument that the insured makes is, well, I was told by the adjuster at the company that they were going to pay in installments and essentially act as my construction manager. And that's not what the policy says. Now, most policies contain language that say that any statement of the insurance adjuster can't modify the terms of the policy. And this is where those come in, is when some insurance adjuster says something that just plainly is not what's in the policy. It can't change the terms of the policy. The policy is the policy, and you can't just unilaterally change them by oral representations. So that argument didn't come up, but I'm sure it was argued in the briefs. This is unfortunately, I think the insurer's got a real problem, and I think they sued the wrong people. They needed to sue the currency exchange where the guy negotiated the check. They needed to sue the banks who negotiated this draft. That's where their remedies are at. I don't know why they sued the insurance company. Maybe they sued the banks too, but it didn't seem they did. But that's where they need to go. That's where the problem lies. The people that didn't check on making sure. I mean, he signed for the mortgagee. So let's suppose the mortgagee's, you know, some bank. He signed for the bank? How did he do that? I mean, who's cashing that check without getting some proof of who he is? That's a bit bizarre. I don't understand. You've got to have better protections in place to make sure that doesn't happen. So, Dan, what are your thoughts?
I agree with you, Pat. I think that's right. You know, but when I was in house at CNA and at Argo Group, a lot of currency exchanges along the border and other things. You know, the one issue with going after currency exchanges and banks is hold in due course, and you know they're pretty minimal, pretty low standards, just because otherwise the banking system would crash. You know what I mean? But good questions here of who endorsed and why you would take a check like that at a currency exchange for $200,000 or $150,000 that has, you know, a bank and other people signing on it, and why the hell he's going to a currency exchange. So, you know, so
well, he went to the currency exchange because he knew they would negotiate.
Well, right. And like I said, we used to always try to chase these down, and, you know, just it's a royal pain. But you're right, too, that this is not unusual. There are cases where the check's issued to the additional insured, to the actual insured, named insured, but it shouldn't have been, and the same types of things, Pat, where the money should have gone somewhere else to the actual claimant or whatever. It's always interesting to me how often people will admit that, yes, they cashed the check because, you know, tough times, whatever the case may be. Like you said here, the PA should have been arrested when he was being deposed and admit it. Should have brought the sheriff in and it's major theft, $150,000 last I checked. You know, if he's only owed, you know, a fraction of it, that's grand larceny.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's bank robbery without a gun.
Right.
I mean, it's
right. It's so.
I don't get it.
But, yeah, I think the insurer's got a hard problem here. So
he does. He went after the wrong people. He's got a remedy. It's just I don't know what the statute of limitations is for these claims. He's got a claim. He's got to bring them against the right people. So with that, that brings us to our BI for COVID. Nothing really to report this week. Nope. We may be phasing out the segment we're talking about at the break, but we need to wait for California to decide. I mean, depending on what California does, this may be just dead.
It may be.
But we'll see what happens. They've got a number of cases. They've taken more. There's brewing over there in California on this issue. Which brings us to our prediction, sure to go wrong. Nothing new this week in terms of cases decided that were relevant or that we had talked about. So our records stand at 209, 47, and 14 for Dan, 205, 50, and 14 for me. Am I down four, really? I thought it was only down three.
That's got to be 206.
I think it's 206. I think I'm only down three.
Yeah, because the math doesn't work otherwise.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which brings us to our cases for this week. Dan, Aero Technologies, a firm?
Yeah, I think so.
And Crothersville Lighthouse Tabernacle, a firm?
Affirmed.
And 13 Investment, a firm?
A firm. All three affirmed this week.
We've had some sweeps of reverses, but this week, all affirmances. Dan, why don't you introduce the rule of the week?
Sure. And you located this one, Pat, in a recent Alabama Supreme Court concurrence that had to do with the Southern Poverty Law Center and some claims being made. A justice of that court wrote a concurrence on the party capitalizing the term blacks in the briefs as being an attempt to influence the court. Above the Law wrote about it. It has seen some other traction. But Pat, why don't you tell us about this? And he cited to the AP policy on style, blacks versus whites. I think the New York Times had an article in the footnote and really almost alleged this woke culture or whatever the case may be. But why don't you tell us more about his concurrence?
For whatever reason in the brief, it was relevant to identify the races of the people involved, and black was capitalized, white was not. And then also in their caption, or
heading?
The signature block. In the signature block at the end of the brief, they gave their pronouns. Fine. If you want to capitalize black, if you want to not capitalize white, if you want to put your pronouns, fine. I really don't care. What the court said was, is you were improperly trying to influence the court. This is a case of know your audience. This is the Alabama Supreme Court. This is not the California Supreme Court. This is not the New York Supreme Court, not the New York Court of Appeals, I should say. This is not the Illinois Supreme Court. This is the Alabama Supreme Court.
I agree,
I'm going to go with that's not. If you were trying to influence the court, you did the opposite of what you're trying to do.
Yeah, except the black and white, as I mentioned, the AP style and other things, it's like Native American or other. Blacks is capitalized because that's just kind of the context, and whites is not traditionally. The pronouns is maybe, I don't know why you would put pronouns in your briefs. Again, if you want to do that. But in any event, it was a special concurrence. Like I said, above the law and others.
APs, I get that it's in the AP, as you're saying, is the Associated Press. Okay, is it in the APA style manual? Is it in the University of Chicago style manual?
It's in the AP style manual, I think. Yeah.
No, I'm that saying was the APA, the American Psychological Association, which is another principal style manual.
Oh, I don't. Right? Yeah, I don't know.
Is it in the University of Chicago style manual? Another prominent style manual. Is it in the blue book? I'd be interested to hear if it's in some of the other leading style manuals. I remember when my mother was working on her dissertation, she had to follow, because the area where she was writing the social sciences, she had to use the APA style manual. And certainly, based on where I went to school, I was familiar with the University of Chicago style manual. But I don't know if it's in either of those manuals.
To
be frank. But I don't think it's the usual course in legal writing, but maybe I'm wrong. But
I don't know.
The court certainly bristled at it and thought it was an improper move to try to influence the court. Just say it didn't work. I don't know if it was going to influence them in any way, but it certainly didn't help. So know your audience, and you ultimately do have a client, and identify, you know, when you put those things, when you put your pronouns in your signature block, when you capitalize black and don't capitalize white, you certainly are disclosing your politics, which is fine, but just be afraid, be, you know, there may be consequences for you and your client as a consequence. That's all. Just something to keep in mind.
Yep.
So with that, we'll take our leave and we'll see everybody next week on the Podium and Panel podcast.
I'm Dan Cotter, and on behalf of my co-host, Pat Eckler, we thank you for listening and look forward to having you join us again. Please follow us on LinkedIn and read our columns in the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. Please join us again at the Podium and Panel. Each episode on the Podium and Panel podcast, we will cover several oral arguments and decisions in civil matters at the Illinois Appellate Court and Illinois Supreme Court, with the occasional coverage of SCOTUS and other appellate courts. The purpose of the podcast is to inform of developments that may affect business and are not to be considered legal advice. They do not create a lawyer-client relationship. Information on previous case results do not guarantee a similar future result. The opinions are their own and do not reflect those of the firms for which they work or their clients.